than hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds.
This is Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1.
This is Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1, the Green Renaissance. And we have a Renaissance woman with us here today, Emmy Ireland, an anthropologist who directs the Waosha Language Documentation Project at the American Research Network. She has worked for the last 40 years with the Waosha and indigenous people residing in the Amazon River in central Brazil. She speaks their language, and she'll tell you a little more about that. Emmy, welcome to the other side of the news.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you. That's America's Research Network, by the way.
So tell us a little about the Waosha.
They're an Arawak-speaking indigenous people. They currently have a population of about 600 in five villages. Some of the villages, they all have these wonderful thatched longhouses. They're one huge room, kind of dark, like a small cathedral. They're really nice. And at the same time, they have in the major villages and two of the larger villages, you have satellite dishes and so on. So they're keeping what is precious to them of their culture and adopting some of the things that they find useful from our culture. As they said to me, your grandfather didn't fly in airplanes and use tape recorders, and so why can't we take advantage of new things also? And I think they're right. In 1954, there was the measles epidemics, now that we're in a time of pandemics, and they suffered a terrible population loss. They were down to 78 people, but they rebounded to about 600. They live in the Xingu Indigenous Lands, which is a demarcated indigenous territory of over 2 million hectares, about the size of the state of Vermont. This area includes the Xingu River Basin, which flows into the Amazon River. Indigenous people have lived continuously in this area for over 1,000 years. That's been discovered in with archaeological research. And they speak an Arawak language. This language family has an immense geographic range. It's a venerable family extending from the Caribbean to the southern Amazon basin. The Taino people of the Caribbean, who had the misfortune of encountering Columbus, they're members of the Arawak family.
All right, and what would we learn from the Waosha? What can they teach us?
Well, every culture has things to teach the rest of humanity, right? But one of the things that impressed me most about the Waosha is their treatment of children. Many chroniclers have talked about the way indigenous children are raised very favorably, but I remember one time the Waosha said to me, one of the elders, he said, your people are like wizards. They completely surpass us. How do they make airplanes? How do they capture my voice on that tape recorder? And then he said to me, and yet your people don't know how to be human beings because they're content to ignore the suffering of children and to deny them food. I've been to your cities and seen how your people will push away hungry children as if they were dogs. And that is not a way for people to live. Then he said, people who hit their children, they put rage into them. And then when they grow up, they will spill that rage on others. So they have a lot of things to teach us, yeah.
Now, how has the pandemic affected them? I mean, relatively isolated people?
Well, it's been hard. It's been very hard emotionally, psychologically. And they are in an ideal situation in a sense, because they are a community of people who can all isolate together. So you have like 200 people in this one village who can continue right now today. They're performing ceremonies, they're dancing, they have musical events, and you know, we would love to be in that situation. At the same time, it's been extremely difficult because the people in other communities that have not had the same ability to stay in lockdown and haven't been as lucky, I guess, just avoiding the virus, they've had deaths, deaths that have affected the community very strongly. The Welsh early on decided to stay in isolation. They have been very disciplined about following their own protocols for keeping the virus from entering their community. And they are fortunate in that they already live in a degree of physical isolation, a degree. There's only one road to the main village, and that's passable for only a few months in the dry season. Other villages can be reached only by boat. And the Welsh are fishermen, all their villages are built beside rivers. So at the same time, especially the young people, they get so frustrated. You know, the older people, they have their partner and they have their responsibilities with their children and so on. But the young people really need the society of their peers. And it's been very hard for the young people to stay in their village and not go to the neighboring villages, not attend ceremonies that they normally look forward to attending, where they would see their friends and their romantic interests and so on. So it's been a bit of a challenge. We have put together a team of researchers and musicians and artists and medical staff from the São Paulo School of Medicine to try to provide information to the Welsh about the virus, because it's kind of a weird thing. You got to explain it because it doesn't follow your normal expectations about how things operate in the world, and to encourage them to stay in quarantine. So that has been my project for the last few months.
Has there been any cases of the virus?
In their five communities, so far there's been no case, not a single case. And that's very unusual. Indigenous people have been hit hard in throughout Latin America and in North America, but they've been physically isolated. And so they've been lucky so far, but the neighboring groups that are just a 2-hour walk away, they have had deaths. And one of the deaths was of a chief that the Welsh considered their paramount chief. And it has had a very sobering effect on them. It's sad. They're feeling fed up with isolation, just as we are here. And every day there's sad news about relatives and friends in other communities who've died. They intermarry with these groups. And the various ethnic groups in the Pixinguinha, they speak different indigenous languages, but they intermarry and they participate together in a shared ceremonial system. So it's been hard. The Welsh were shocked and demoralized when this chief, Aritana Yewalapiti, died. And so although they've been fortunate so far in keeping the virus out of their communities, they haven't escaped the sorrow, the loss, the destabilization that it has brought to their entire region.
And I remember in the past news accounts from born-again missionary groups, Lost Tribes Mission, who encountered indigenous people in the Amazon rainforest with devastating results in terms of disease.
Yes, well, I've been going to work with the Welsh for 40 years now. And in the old days, if I had this lightest cold, I couldn't go in. I'd come all the way from America and I'd have to wait. And I seemed like neurotic on the airplane. It was in those days, and it's right, everything I was rubbing down with alcohol, I couldn't bring anything in because they were very sensitive. Now they've been exposed to a lot of the bugs that circulate in our society. But in 1954, they were still extremely susceptible, and they, as I said, they had a horrible, devastating epidemic. So, yeah.
What about the threats to them by the exploitation of the Amazon rainforest and river basin and their own government policies? Are there threats there as well?
Sure. And I should mention that one of the issues during this period, during the pandemic, speaking of the evangelical missionaries, is that the Bolsonaro government is very much in favor of evangelizing the indigenous people. And it has put indigenous evangelists, those who would evangelize the indigenous people at the head of the agency that is in charge of protecting indigenous groups. So there have been a number of cases in which evangelicals were trying to get into these communities, and in some cases they succeeded in doing so. And that has been something that others in Brazil who are want to avoid any chance of infecting these indigenous people, they have been fighting against. But it's been a difficult situation. As here, it has been chaotic at times. There's conflicting information. It's been very politicized. Bolsonaro is an admirer of Trump. And so it's been difficult for the indigenous people. In terms of receiving help from the government, the current political environment for indigenous people in Brazil is very challenging. The president, Jair Bolsonaro, governs from the far right. He's long advocated that Brazil would be better off without indigenous people. In 1990, he said, and I quote, the North American cavalry were the competent ones. Now this, of course, this is an English translation. He spoke in Portuguese. Because they decimated their indigenous people in the past. And today, they don't have this problem in their country. He's complaining about the amount of land set aside for Brazil's indigenous people. He's also long advocated getting rid of protections for indigenous lands altogether. In 2018, he said his campaign, and this is one that really struck at the heart of the Wausha. He says not one square centimeter of land will be, of demarcated indigenous land will remain after the end of his tenure. Not one centimeter of land will be demarcated for indigenous reserves. He wants to get rid of that whole system. He feels it's an industry. And that indigenous land should be open to economic exploitation, including agribusiness and mining. Mining is very destructive because it often involves the introduction of toxic metals into local water systems.
Could you shed any information on the fires that occurred there? Were those due to climate change? Were they intentionally set? Are they both? Is it part of a policy? And should we be concerned?
You know, look at our nation, and it's always a very complex confluence of factors. So you have climate change that is occurring independently of a deforestation as a global system, and then you also have the desiccation of the forest that is caused by people chopping trees down, and then the trees that are left are not protected by the other trees, and they start to dry out. And then the other problem of just lands being completely razed of trees. Now, in the link that where you can see images of the Wausha and find out more about them, it's www.wauja.org. You can see a picture from Google that you can find yourself if you look at just the continent of South America, and you look square in the middle, and there's something that looks like a big green epiglottis, and that is the Xingu indigenous land, and around it, it's green and healthy, but all around it is land that has been stripped of trees for usually large-scale agriculture, industrialized agriculture, cattle farming. Some of the same things that are happening in Nicaragua. So it's a problem because, go ahead and I understand you need to take a break.
Well, WGRN 94.1, the Green Renaissance. And we're talking again with Emmy Ireland on the Wausha. Proceed.
So just as there's no racial purity is a notion we need to get rid of, Indigenous people quite rightly feel frustrated at when they are expected to be living the same way their ancestors did. And these are people who are maintaining their language, their religious traditions, their ceremonies, and many of their customs, but they are also changing too. And just as we change from generation to generation, not only technologically, but in terms of our the way we operate in society, what we consider appropriate behavior. You know that people variously complain or are delighted with the way millennials are different from boomers. So as a group, still they would not describe themselves as pristine, but they would describe themselves as Wausha. And as I said, I remember the old man who said to me, your grandfather didn't fly in airplanes. Why do we have to? But you consider yourself an American. You don't feel that you're not an American anymore because you don't get around on a horse. So they're right. They're right. The important thing is that they have the ability to determine how they're going to live, and that they are able to maintain their culture to the degree that they feel is appropriate. Those are the important things. But the desiccation of the rainforest, the way the rainforest is being torn down all around their area. When you look at the satellite picture, you'll see that, wow, you can tell the indigenous land. You can see exactly where the boundaries of the indigenous land are from the fact that it's green. And that tells you why it's important that indigenous people are allowed to continue to be stewards of these regions. They're not perfect stewards in every respect, but my gosh, they're doing a heck of a lot better job than anybody else. And it's very important that these indigenous territories continue to exist.
And one of the things you mentioned is sort of the tension of the indigenous people, and that was reflected in a photo contest. Yes. Would you care to reflect at all on that?
Well, it's not a bad tension. It's a very good one. Because there's, you know, the old-fashioned way of doing anthropology, or maybe that's just my point of view, but I think, let's put it this way, the way I was trained is that you're supposed to go in and be respectful of the people you're working with, but you're trying to interfere as little as possible to not have...
So you're an observer, and you're not supposed to be a change agent.
Yeah, you're not supposed to be a change agent. And you know, here we are. We are actively trying to keep them from getting exposed to the virus. We have an agenda. We're trying to keep them alive, help them stay alive. We've organized these people to bring food, and not so much food, but I shouldn't say that because that's not even what they're bringing in. To bring in medicines, to bring in medical supplies, masks, oxygen, materials for building an isolation center. Things like fish hooks that get used up and bitten off and so on, and they need to get more of agricultural tools. All those things have to be brought in on a regular basis. Soap, hygiene materials. And so we're definitely affecting things. And so I see the work I do as a matter of collaborative, community-based projects. So these are projects in which the indigenous people decide what they think is important for the outsider to work on them with. And you shape the project. Every aspect of the project has to be shaped by all the participants. So the indigenous people shape it, the outsiders shape it. And each has different forms of power. The indigenous people have a power to make, to put pressure on the outsiders, and the outsiders have economic power, and you have to be aware of that. But all these things need to be discussed. So I got a small grant recently, and really small, just a couple hundred bucks to in return for writing an article. And I thought, well, why not do a photo contest for the young people because they're bored out of their skulls. And I thought they might have some fun. And also, the more they get bored, the more I get messages saying, I'm going to go to the city next week. I can't do this anymore.
And how do these indigenous people message you, contact you? Are they using?
WhatsApp. We have WhatsApp group. We have group chats every day, every morning around dawn.
So is this on phones, on smartphones?
Smartphones. Some of them have laptops. They're very avid users of internet technology. They are skilled photographers and ethnographers. I am deeply proud to say that there are about 11 of this small population of 600 people, young people who are excellent ethnographers of their own community and very committed. And today I got, while I was preparing for this talk, I was just looking over my notes and I had to look at a video by one of the young men who was very excited. He sent it to me and he had video recorded a ceremony that they're performing there. And it happened to be one that I had not seen. I lived there for over 2 years, but I had not seen that one. They had not performed it while I was there. So the thing is that it's very important to record these ceremonies because if you don't remember all the words to a song, you can't perform the ceremony. It would be as if you lost, all of Shakespeare's works. You can't perform his plays anymore unless somebody has memorized them. So it's really important what they're doing. So when I proposed the photo contest, one of the young men said, "Well, I don't want to be photographed. You guys don't photograph me." And we talked about that, and it was an opportunity to discuss it because outsiders come in and they take pictures of Indigenous people, and they post them on the internet for sale. And there's no such thing as getting a release or paying the person or sharing any profits. And you can find images of the Wowsha for sale online at $100 a pop. And they don't like that. And so we talked about that. And this is something new, having outsiders come in and exploiting them economically that way. And it was an opportunity to discuss that. And we all agreed that anyone who doesn't want to be photographed for this project, no problem. And then the same young man, I think it was, contacted me privately, not in the group, and said, "Well, I really like that you agreed that I shouldn't have to be photographed if I don't want to be. However, I still don't want to participate as a photographer because you probably will just choose your favoritos, your favorites." So, I don't think I would. I make a point of trying to make sure every person has an opportunity to participate. In fact, we have a rule when I go down and I have professional camera and audio equipment, and the young people get to operate that equipment, recording their elders giving one-off lectures about various things, how to spin cotton or how to fix the last generation of men who know how to fix an arrow or make a bow. They're old men now. The young people don't know that. So I have a rule that they can only, that everybody has to take turns. They can't do it again until we've gone through the whole group of young people who want to participate. So I try actively not to do that. So nonetheless, he was very legitimate in saying to me, this could be something that could be corrupted. So I said, okay, submit them to me anonymously. So the whole idea is they should be shaping the project. So some people wanted to opt out, that's fine. He wanted it to be anonymous submissions to make sure that the judges were not leaning on the scales, and that's fine too. And on the other hand, I pushed back and I said, I want to see half of I want to have half of the prize categories of $25 for women and half for men. And the prizes are small, but that way we can make 18 of them. So, and then they said, well, we should be able to do the judging. How about we vote? So of course, why not? So then we'll have, people's choice and so on. So the whole idea is, and like on a collaborative project, you want to work together so that everybody helps to shape it.
Well, this sort of begs the question, how are they educated? What's their educational model?
Well, they have various kinds of education. The traditional education is gotten from the elders, from the parents, the grandparents, the aunts and uncles. You can also pay for education if you're a young man who is inclined to learn the traditional lore. and your immediate family members are not educated that way, you can go and chop wood for someone. And once they take a shine to you and realize that you're a serious young person, they can agree to teach you and they'll be your mentor. But in terms of the more, in terms of, let's say, the national education, for instance, learning Portuguese and going to a grammar school, they have village school teachers who have been trained in the cities. They go out and finish high school in this in one of the nearby border towns, and then they can apply to a specialized college for training Indigenous teachers. And at this time, most of the Indigenous teachers are male because it's difficult to ask families to send a 15-year-old girl to finish high school in a border town, and those border towns are not places a parent would want to send a 15-year-old girl to live alone. So they send their boys. But that means that all of a sudden, for the laudable project of literacy, they have introduced a system that gives education to men and economic opportunities to men and not women. It didn't used to be like that.
You mean it didn't? It wasn't like that when it was when they had less interaction?
Yeah, in 1980, they didn't speak any Portuguese. There was maybe one or two people who had picked up a little bit of Portuguese, but certainly not enough to carry on a conversation comfortably. And everybody else spoke only Wauxia. I was lucky because it made it much easier to learn Wauxia. My younger colleagues, I have to try to incentivize them to go through the drudgery of not being able to speak coherently for quite a while as you're learning it. And I say, you know, you're not going to get my tapes from the 80s unless unless you learn the language. And they're slowly doing it. But it's hard. It was much easier for me. I had no choice.
Now, it looks like we're about to run out of time. I wanted to give a chance to direct people to your site.
Yes. For more information on the Wauxia, I hope you will visit www.wauxia.org, and you can see images of the Wauxia, learn how they've been dealing with the pandemic, and perhaps spread the word, because just as we need the stimulus funds here desperately, because they can't sell their normal crafts, they are accomplished ceramists and sculptors, they can't do those things now, so they need stimulus money, and we're a rich country, so even 1,000 people giving $5 would make a huge difference. So if you can go there, that would really help. That's a way you can help.
All right, Emmy Ireland, thank you for sharing your experience with
the Wauxia.
Thank you
for inviting me, Bob. Thank you so much. Thank you. I know you have a great
audience.
I enjoyed
it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Other Side of the News. This is Bob Fitrakis.
And Dan Dugan, WGRN 94.1 LPFM, The Green Renaissance.